supposing we hit the body with a tremendous, whether it's ultraviolet or just very powerful light, supposing you brought the light inside the body, which you can do either through the skin or in some other way. And then I see the disinfectant where it knocks it out in a minute, 1 minute. And is there a way we can do something like that by injection inside or almost a cleaning?
Yeah.
That's pretty powerful.
Yeah, pretty powerful. Bleach! Inject it. I remember that. Wonder how the White House correspondents felt about it.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
They had to live through
that. I got the feeling that something ain't right.
We'll find out.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK, 90.7 FM in L.A., 98.7 in Santa Barbara, 93.7 in San Diego, 99.5 in Ridgecrest and China Lake. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains, KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's Queso, Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950, KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internet to the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing Planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. I mentioned Donald Trump's comments about injecting himself with bleach and so forth, and what the White House correspondents who had to deal with that, who had to deal with that madness, may have thought at that particular moment. We will find out soon enough from one of them. But before we get there, the LA Times recently reported that new COVID variants are spreading in California. How worried should we be, says the headline. Well, the answer, which Desi Doyen and I can report firsthand, is somewhat concerned at this point.
It's still happening.
Yeah. If you're a regular listener to the show, you know that Des picked it up again a few weeks ago and traveling to the Midwest and back. And last week, I subsequently picked it up again from either her or another source. I'm thinking it was you, Des. In any event,
probably
there is said to be another COVID spike underway in Southern California of late and elsewhere around the country. The good news is the latest variants do not appear to be any more severe, particularly than the previous ones. But the bad news is that they are a bit more virulent, a bit more easily transmissible. Health officials are advising people to keep up to date on vaccinations and take precautions as infection rates could continue to rise this summer. And yes, you might want to even consider masking up again if you are among those particularly vulnerable. I'm happy to say, however, after a tough week for me last week, though with largely mild symptoms throughout, I tested negative over the weekend. Hooray. So I am back, baby, at least for now, and with a guest joining us momentarily in studio today, who I thought must be brave to be willing to join us so recently after I had previously been positive for COVID. And then I remembered that, oh yeah, my guest, formerly a White House correspondent during the Trump administration, had also been one of the first civilians to enter the Fukushima nuclear plant after its meltdown in 2011. So between a nuclear meltdown and the Trump White House, I figure he can take much worse than me a few days after a COVID infection in a tiny studio. Steve Herman, chief national correspondent for Voice of America, will join us momentarily. However, I've got a few. Oh, and he's already tweeted out. Yeah. If you know his Twitter handle, you can go look what he's tweeted. Anyway, a few quick news items before we get to Steve today. Last week, Desi Doyen warned on this show in her latest Green News report about the extreme heat wave, which is moving up from the U.S. South and Southeast into the Midwest and soon to much of the East Coast. Rather than heat wave, I guess we should say heat dome, Desi Doyen.
Yes, we should.
Because it ain't moving. Back here in L.A., however, we're also having our own share of climate change-induced dangers. As of this past weekend, firefighters are battling a series of wildfires that broke out across California over the weekend amid early summer heat and dry, gusty winds, resulting in a number of structures destroyed, thousands of acres charred, evacuations in some locations, and shutdowns of major highways over the weekend, including on the 5 north of L.A. The National Weather Service warned that winds that carry, quote, the potential for rapid fire spread were forecast across large swaths of the state as of Monday morning, including the Antelope Valley and foothills, as well as Santa Barbara County in Southern California and in Northern California's wine country and Sacramento Valley. We've had some warm weather over the weekend out here, along with some gusty winds and very dry conditions. All of that following a wetter than usual winter, which ironically, Desi Doyen, also means that we have a lot more vegetation out there now to serve as fuel for these fires.
Yeah, it's like you can't get anything good that lasts for long because
exactly.
You get all these great storms that helped California get out of its drought. But unfortunately, now we have all this vegetation that's now drying out quickly in this early season heat. And that is causing an early start to the wildfire season.
The largest fire in the state Monday morning is being called the Post Fire. It's in L.A. County. It had burned some 15,000 acres as of Monday morning and was just 8% contained, according to CAL FIRE. More than 1,100 firefighters and half a dozen helicopters are battling the flames. The fire along the 5 freeway near Gorman triggered evacuations for 1,200 people in the Hungry Valley Park and Pyramid Lake areas. L.A. County Fire Department crews rapidly responded, making aerial assaults with air tankers and water-dropping helicopters. The Ventura County Fire Department and U.S. Forest Service were aiding in that effort. More than 15 fires have started since Saturday in California and have burned more than 20,000 acres, according to the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection website. There could be more ahead. Areas from Redding down to Modesto are under a red flag warning through Tuesday due to the combination of summer heat, winds, low humidity, and unusually warm overnight temperatures. On Monday morning, and this one I can somewhat personally confirm today, a vegetation fire broke out in the Hollywood Hills just south of Runyon Canyon, close to where we live, which explains the helicopters that sounded like they were flying into my bedroom in the middle of the night. The small fire was not far from homes, according to the LA Times, but it was hidden in a difficult to access area. It took firefighters and water dropping helicopters more than an hour to put out the flames, despite it burning only 400 square feet, according to the department. Des?
Yes, I know, and it was
400 square feet.
It was really loud. But yeah, that's the kind of fire weather that we are in right now, where even the smallest vegetation, the smallest spark, can really really go badly very quickly.
Now,
so be careful out there.
We were talking earlier about this seems to be an earlier start to fire season than usual. Your response?
Yes, it absolutely is an earlier start to fire season than usual. In fact, at the Wildfire Interdisciplinary Research Center at Ooh. San Jose State University, they said that the post fire, the point fire up to Lake Sonoma, that it stands as an outlier right now because usually, we'll get early season grass fires, but this was different because it's actually trees and shrubs that are burning, and that's not typical for this time. Usually trees don't start burning until later in the year because they take longer to dry out after the winter and spring storms.
You have also pointed out a number of times, particularly on the Green News Report, that fire season at this point, yes, it's starting earlier, but at this point it's kind of gotten to be year-round.
Yes, yes, it is year-round, but it is weird. It is weird to have it explode quite this early. Now, there's one other thing that I think is important to point out. People need to be very careful when they are in an area where there is wildfire smoke. A new study from UCLA estimates that wildfire smoke killed more than 50,000 Californians prematurely in the 10-year period between 2008 and 2018.
Not from the fires themselves, but from the smoke.
Exactly, the wildfire smoke, because it contains teeny tiny particles that are called particulate matter, and they are small enough to enter the bloodstream, the heart, and the lungs when they are inhaled, and that those little particles can raise the risk of dying from heart disease or lung disease or strokes. So it's that's a study that covers the chronic exposure to wildfire, not just short-term exposure to wildfire smoke, but long-term chronic exposure over time.
Oh, you
and
mean
it's the first of its kind to do that.
Those of us who, for example, live in Southern California and we have to deal with fires every season.
Or up in Washington State or up in Oregon or Northern California. Gotcha. So it is something to consider to have, taking extra precautions when officials mention ways that you can protect yourself from wildfire smoke.
Thank you very much. In some quick international news today, that may be no better than the local news at this point, Israel's far-right Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu criticized plans announced by the Israeli military, the IDF, on Sunday to hold daily tactical pauses in fighting along one of the main roads into Gaza to facilitate aid delivery into the Palestinian enclave. According to Reuters today, an Israeli official said, quote, when the prime minister heard the reports of a daily 11-hour humanitarian pause in the morning, he turned to his military secretary and made it clear that that was unacceptable to him. Unacceptable to allow humanitarian aid into a region where people are starving and dying, as requested by his nation's own military, by the way. The IDF clarified that normal operations would continue nonetheless in Rafah. That's the main focus of its operation in southern Gaza, as international aid organizations continue to warn of a growing humanitarian crisis. National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, who leads one of the far-right nationalist religious parties in Netanyahu's ruling coalition, denounced the idea of a tactical pause, saying whoever decided it was a, quote, fool who should lose their job. The spat was the latest in a series of clashes between members of that coalition and the Israeli military over the conduct of the war, now in its ninth month. It came a week after centrist former IDF chief Benny Gantz quit the coalition government, accusing Netanyahu of having no effective strategy in Gaza and charging that, in fact, Netanyahu has been undermining the release of Israeli hostages for, as he described, political reasons. Which seems a good moment to remind you yet again that the war in Gaza is unlikely to ever end, at least so long as Netanyahu heads up the Israeli government, given that he will almost certainly be removed as prime minister if and when fighting ultimately stops, at which time he stands to face long-standing felony corruption charges from long before the war broke out last year, and now will also very likely have to face war crimes charges by the International Criminal Court. All of this is baked into the political cake and, in my opinion, does not receive nearly the attention from the news media that it should. How much it is that Netanyahu essentially needs this war to continue. On Monday, Netanyahu formally dissolved the influential war cabinet that has overseen the fighting, according to a government spokesperson. A not unexpected move that comes days after Gantz bolted from the coalition government. Gantz's absence, unfortunately, from the government increases Netanyahu's dependence on his even farther right ultranationalist allies, who oppose a ceasefire. That could pose an additional challenge to the already fragile negotiations to somehow end the 8-month war in Gaza. The war cabinet was formed in the early days of the war when Gantz, then an opposition party leader and Netanyahu rival at the time, joined the coalition in a show of unity following the October 7 attack on southern Israel by Hamas. Netanyahu has played a balancing act throughout the war, as AP notes today, weighing pressure from Israel's top ally, the U.S., and growing global opposition to the fighting, as well as from his farther right government partners who have threatened to topple the government should Israel move ahead on a ceasefire deal. The latest proposal is part of the Biden administration's most concentrated push to help wind down the war. For now, however, progress on a deal does appear to be stalled. Critics say Netanyahu's wartime decision-making has been influenced by the ultranationalists in his government and, thank you for mentioning this, AP, by his desire to remain in power. I would add, to remain out of jail as well. Netanyahu denies the accusations, says he has the country's best interests in mind. Gantz's departure, while not posing a direct threat to Netanyahu's rule, did rock Israeli politics at a sensitive time. The popular former military chief was seen as a statesman who boosted Israel's credibility with its international partners at a time when Israel finds itself at its most isolated. Gantz is now an opposition party leader in parliament. Netanyahu's government is Israel's most religious, most nationalist ever. In Israel's fractious parliamentary system, Netanyahu relies on a group of small parties to help keep his government afloat. Without the support of Gantz's party, however, Netanyahu is expected to be more beholden to those far-right allies. All right. In short, I would caution, don't look for that ceasefire to happen anytime soon. I hope that I am wrong. But it will not help Netanyahu to have that ceasefire. And that, unfortunately, has been at the core of this war, in my opinion, since Israel began its deadly response to Hamas's horrific assault on southern Israel in October of last year. All right, we will take a quick pause here, ourselves at least, and we'll come back to be joined live here in studio by the great Steve Herman. What? Steve Herman of the Voice of America will be here with us. You are listening to the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At the Bradcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently, without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Trying. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. In his brand new book, Behind the White House Curtain, a senior journalist's story of covering the president and why it matters, Steve Herman, who served as the White House bureau chief for the nonpartisan, nonprofit, government-funded, independent media outlet Voice of America during the 4 years of the Trump administration and the first 8 months or so of the Biden administration, discusses, among other things, the importance of serving as part of the rotating team of pool reporters who are standing by, essentially, 24/7 to cover the president and anything that he might say or do at times that the full White House media contingent cannot otherwise cover. Pool reporters will share their reports to the rest of the media as they happen, if and when news happens, while the rest of the media may not be on duty, essentially, or when the president is in a particular location that cannot accommodate the full contingent of reporters who cover the White House on a daily basis. Such was the case, as he recounts in his new book, when at Mar-a-Lago on the evening of April 6, 2017, not long after Trump had first taken office, as Herman writes, the Chinese president, Xi Jinping, had barely departed Trump's private club, and we expected any moment to be given the signal for a partial lid, writes Herman. That means the end of the day for the poolers, as there would be no further appearances or external movement by the president. Instead, he writes, we were instructed to line up outside one of the oceanfront club's entrances and stand by, although the pool was not informed as to why. During our hiatus, we were then told that Trump would make a statement. After a long wait, we were rushed into a conference room where the president quickly appeared. There was no time to set up our equipment and test the audio levels. In a near panic, he says, I slammed one end of my XLR cable into the audio distribution box and blindly hit the record button. I didn't have a spare second to put on my headphones before Trump began speaking.
My fellow Americans, on Tuesday, Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad launched a horrible chemical weapons attack on innocent civilians using a deadly nerve agent. Tonight I ordered a targeted military strike on the airfield in Syria from where the chemical attack was launched.
It was major news, writes Steve Herman, the first use of military force by Donald Trump. He says we would later learn the 59 cruise missiles began exploding on the Syrian airfield as Trump and Xi were having dessert. The American leader informed his Chinese counterpart of the airstrikes that he had ordered as Xi, according to Trump, was enjoying, quote, the most beautiful piece of chocolate cake that you have ever seen. I had assumed Trump's announcement had been carried live on TV, writes Herman. It had not. First word of it came from the radio and print pool reporters. But I did not find out that was the case until about an hour later. Herman reports that, in fact, the audio that the TV pool reporters had captured during their videotaping of the historic moment had actually failed for some reason. So if you heard that audio back when it happened or in the years since, it was most likely the audio that was recorded by Steve Herman that night at Mar-a-Lago, since, as he notes, it was his audio that would be used by all of the TV networks. This was a lesson, he writes, that reinforced Voice of America's critical role as a radio pooler, no matter the hour or the location. When the organization was tapped as part of the regular rotation of media outlets, sometimes several times a month, to serve as poolers for that important duty. In another instance, Herman describes in some of the darkest hours covering the White House amid the worst pandemic in 100 years, he reports that covering Trump at some of his rambling news conferences, quote, could be a frustrating experience, I bet. He details one instance in the White House briefing room where he was allowed to ask Trump a question about states collectively taking matters into their own hands on deciding when to reopen, a move that undermined Trump's directives. Quote, he began replying while I was still in mid-sentence, having decided he needed to hear nothing further. His answer summed up his simple, vague, and somewhat contradictory philosophical approach to the presidency, which would cause him no shortage of legal grief after his term in office. The president of the United States, Trump said, has the authority to do what the president has the authority to do, which is very powerful. The president of the United States calls the shots. If we weren't here for the states, you would have had a problem in this country like you've never seen before. We were here to back them up, and we more than backed them up. We did a job that nobody ever thought was possible. It's a decision for the president of the United States. Trump continued his convoluted explanation, writes Herman, that it was, quote, like a microchip. They're pinpointed, he said. We have local government that hopefully will do a good job, and if they don't do a good job, I'd step in so fast they can't do anything without the approval of the president of the United States. Okay. As Herman observes in Behind the White House Curtain, detailing yet another task that Voice of America is responsible for that most commercial news outlets are not, he said, quote, imagine having to report that succinctly and simply so that it could be understood in more than 45 languages. That, he writes, was my job. Those are among the many responsibilities for the White House bureau chief, working as Herman has for decades with the quasi-independent government media outlet Voice of America. I say quasi-independent because even though VOA and dozens of its sister media outlets broadcasting around the world under the oversight of the U.S. Agency for Global Media, or USAGM, are statutorily independent operations funded by the U.S. government, but required to operate completely independent from its political direction, the Trump administration, during Herman's time in the White House, attempted to corrupt that norm as well, to pierce that long-standing firewall. In fact, the administration mounted a full-throated attack on Voice of America and Steve Herman himself with a Trump appointee assigned to oversee the many outlets managed by the USAGM, actually overseeing the creation of a dossier on Steve Herman. Steve is a decades-long veteran journalist. He spent more than some 26 years based in Asia, which is where I first got to know his work during his indispensable coverage, much of it on Twitter, of the meltdown at the nuclear reactor plants in Fukushima back in 2011. His travels have taken him to more than 75 countries, including on-scene reporting from combat zones, civil uprisings, areas struck by major natural disasters. And all of that before he began covering the White House during the Trump administration. After his coverage of the Trump White House in the first several months of the Biden White House as VOA's White House bureau chief, he is now chief national correspondent for Voice of America and joins us live in studio once again today. Welcome back, Mr. Herman. Congrats on the new book. And I should note that I discovered late last night at the back of the book in your acknowledgement section, my name was one of those you thanked, and I don't know what I did, frankly, to deserve that mention, but it was an honor, especially since I was sandwiched between NPR's excellent David Folkenflik and the legendary CBS Radio News White House correspondent Mark Knoller. So thank you for that and for joining us again in the studio.
Thank you for having me, Brad. And yes, you get some credit in the book. You, I think, over the years have been a supporter of the type of journalism that we've done. Yep. And understood what is the mission of the Voice of America. So I'm grateful for that.
You have helped me to understand it over the years, and I think not enough people understand it and the importance of it. And that sort of came into view again after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and suddenly we realized how important it was to have these voices out over the airwaves, as everybody's thinking, oh, we don't need radio anymore, we don't need shortwave anymore, we don't need all of the things that Voice of America has been able to supply over so many years. So thank you for continuing that and to keep it alive. We'll get to it in a bit, under assault, frankly, from the Trump administration. I've just been recovering, as you know, from my bout with COVID, and I thought about, will you want to join me in a tiny little studio? And then I remembered you were one of the first civilians to actually enter the Fukushima nuclear reactor plant after that disaster. And then you served in the White House during the worst pandemic in 100 years. So my question, Steve Herman, which was more unnerving, going into Fukushima after the meltdown or into the Trump White House during the pandemic?
Well, that's a tough question to answer.
You're welcome.
They were a little bit different with the nuclear meltdown of the power plants. We really didn't know how bad it was going to get, but I could take radiation readings daily, consult with what the government readings, local government was saying, mm-hmm. and make prudent decisions about whether to stay or go. With COVID, I guess that for a long time we didn't know how bad it was going to get either. But we did have protocols in place, which obviously were supposed to mitigate the risk. But especially at the beginning when nobody really knew what was going on. Yeah. And then we started to get conflicting information from the top of the U.S. government, in fact, in the actual building that I was spending most of my time. And it was also for us, who are supposed to be telling the rest of the world what's going on and what to do. It was a sort of slightly scary experience.
The unflappable Steve Herman was flapped in that gig. And especially since the protocols, as you describe in the book, you had protocols, but they seem to be consistently violated by none other than the President of the United States himself and his staff at those regular briefings.
And the vice president, too, who seemed to be pressured or intimidated into not wearing a mask at the Mayo Clinic. And mm-hmm. I was also there, and that caused some trouble as well. So, yes, the journalists themselves were the ones pushing for more protocols than the White House press office. We voluntarily reduced the number of people in the press briefing room. If you remember, mm-hmm. there were a lot of empty seats yep. there.
And there's not a lot to begin with in that room.
48, 49 yep. seats total.
Yep.
So that was something that we did voluntarily, which President Trump did not really like, because when he came in to do those briefings, he wanted to see a full house out there because mm-hmm. that looked good, obviously, on the TV cameras. And if it's a half-filled or quarter-filled audience, the perception was, oh, not that the journalists had voluntarily done something prudent health-wise, but that perhaps the reporters were losing interest in what the president was saying.
Mm. When the reporters were just trying to stay alive. You discuss in your book the moment that it became public that Trump had tested positive himself for COVID, that he had actually tested positive, I think, 4 days earlier, but did not make that public at the time. And that ultimately he became gravely ill. He almost died, reportedly, but much of that was kept from the public. Seems reprehensible, especially to folks, you know, around him like yourself, frankly, in close quarters, to not let them know. But your book also helpfully gives a lot of history to sort of put that in context. The Trump administration was hardly the first to lie about health issues regarding the president.
Yes, this probably goes almost all the way back to George Washington, who was definitely not our healthiest president either. But there were some real incidents, for example, with Grover Cleveland, where surgery was secretly performed on a ship, and they were telling the United States that basically he just had a dental procedure done, and it was actually a cancerous tumor being removed. And of course, we were talking before the show about mm-hmm. Franklin Roosevelt.
Yeah.
And during that time, most people were not aware that he was running the presidency from a wheelchair. And any time a photographer dared to take a picture of him in the wheelchair, they would have their camera physically taken by agents trying to prevent this from being publicized. And by the time he ran for president for his fourth term, he was gravely ill. And that was also covered up somewhat, I believe, with the complicity of the reporters who are covering the White House.
That said, it seems like it's one thing what you're talking about there. It's another thing when we're talking about a communicable disease. And that was this the first time in your research that was actually what they were covering up was, well, the president of the United States has a communicable disease and people are flying on Air Force One with the president.
We did have a president in the early 20th century who almost died of influenza during the mm-hmm. the 1918 flu
pandemic. Yeah.
So it's not unprecedented in that regard. I think what was unprecedented, this was happening in a day and age of instantaneous communication, and definitely in an era where I can say that the White House press was no longer complicit mm-hmm. or being intimidated by the White House about covering up presidential health scares.
There was a point when, speaking of intimidating the press corps, there was a point when one of your VOA colleagues who was working with you at the White House, who has an Asian-sounding name, so I'm going to assume she is of Asian descent. Correct me if I'm wrong, but she was asked by Trump during a briefing, who she was with. And she said, Voice of America. And he sort of sneered, as you explained in the book, and said, wow, amazing. Now, you didn't detail it in the book, but what did you make of that smear and his reaction to her?
Well, he was talking with Patsy Widakuswara, who succeeded me as White House bureau chief, and she is a native of Indonesia.
Mm-hmm.
And she came from our Indonesian service, a super competent reporter, obviously. And that was not the first instance where it was noted that President Trump seemed to respond to and treat minority female reporters much differently than he did with white male reporters.
I was sort of taken by that comment, you know, when he says, wow, amazing, as if to say, wow, amazing, we have this sort of person working at Voice of America, which he kind of regards as we would learn, as his own personal propaganda tool, right?
There was no elaboration from him on why he found Patsy's employment as a White House correspondent for the Voice of America amazing, as sometimes, you know, other things he says are open to some interpretation.
Now, was that before or after that moment with Patsy? Was that before or after the administration had made a move against the Voice of America's parent organization? That would be the Agency for Global Media, in an attempt, as we'll discuss, to undermine Voice of America itself. And might that have had anything to do with him saying, we got to do something about this VOA?
It was a bit of a slow burn, lighting the fuse on that.
Mm-hmm.
The best I can fathom, the attacks that were coming from the White House on the Voice of America at that time really had nothing to do with our journalism. It appeared that Trump had an initial interest in VOA, but when he found out it was, by law, an external broadcasting service and could not be turned into a U.S. government domestic broadcast service, he seemed to have less interest for a number of years.
Huh.
And then getting into the latter years of the Trump administration, there had been a holdup for the confirmation in the Senate of the person to head our parent organization, which you mentioned, U.S. Agency for Global Media. And there were Republicans on Capitol Hill that were reluctant to bring forth this nomination because of some controversies in the background of the nominee. And that's when we seemed to see the attacks on VOA ramped up.
And so this part of this, and you described in the book, there was an actual dossier written up about you, Steve Herman. They were targeting you as much as Voice of America overall, but, you know, they were concerned about you. So in short, why did that happen as you see it? What did you do to earn the ire of Trump world? And perhaps most importantly, has the threat to Voice of America itself passed with the subsequent administration of Joe Biden?
Yes, obviously things are a lot different and stable now because we don't have our parent agency trying to do radical change.
Mm-hmm.
In my particular case, I think there were a couple things going on. One, when the new CEO of USAGM came in, Michael Pack, he made no secret. He gave a number of interviews to conservative podcasts saying that he wanted to drain the swamp at VOA. And, you know, it's one thing to perhaps go after somebody in our Swahili service or Urdu service, but I was fairly high profile.
Yeah.
And I think he was just looking for a head on a pike to, you know, demonstrate that, okay, we did make some sort of symbolic, if nothing else, type of change here. And I would have been a good head on a pike.
And so was there ever any explanation about what they wanted, what you did wrong, what they could what they could or should change at VOA?
Well, there was a perception that Voice of America was not stepping in line with the Trump administration, that I and others were guilty of anti-Trump bias, allegedly. And anytime anybody has said that, whether they think I'm anti-Trump or anti-Biden or anti-whoever, go look at the stories we write and show me where the bias is. And so the dossier, I think, was an attempt to try to prove that. And thanks to the support we had from Capitol Hill, bipartisan support, when these cases as a whistleblower, when we went to federal judges and groups such as the Government Accountability Project and subsequent federal government independent investigations proved that this sort of attack on us was wrong and we were doing nothing wrong, that there was no proof of these allegations against us.
And I know that you have you're often required to explain sort of how Voice of America is not a propaganda arm of the U.S. government. It's statutorily barred from doing that sort of thing. So in one sense, it kind of seems like the attack from the Trump administration on the Voice of America, essentially, I see it as trying to essentially capture control of the parent agency, certainly. But seeing that by a presidential administration itself, in hopes of, I guess, changing the reporting in some fashion, doesn't that sort of do the Voice of America a favor, demonstrating that very point that, you know, you can't, are you actually propaganda if the president of the United States is actually just furious about what you guys are doing?
Yes. And Donald Trump was not the first president to really not like the fact that the Voice of America broadcasting to the rest of the world about what's happening in the United States and at the White House was not just parroting the press releases coming out of the West Wing. So, if whoever whatever administration wants to change that, they need to change the law. That would have to be an act of Congress, literally, to turn VOA into a propaganda agency of any particular administration.
But surely the Trump administration was the first to actually make such an overt move against, you know, maybe not. Others have done.
If you really want to dig down into the history of this.
I do. That's why we got your book.
Yeah, Reagan administration, Charles Z. Wick was appointed to head the parent organization. There were some battles during that administration as well. And I'm sure Democratic administrations also have been frustrated. And I know people at the State Department who think don't understand what VOA is and are upset when VOA is not towing the line of the State Department as well.
I gotcha. Well, one of the times that you actually rankled the Trump White House that you discussed in the book was when you tweeted out a video of a celebration in Wuhan. I might have even seen it on your feed.
Well, it wasn't I have to correct you. It wasn't a tweet. It was actually a piece of video relayed from Associated Press Television of a celebration in China. And I don't even know if it ran on the air. It ran on maybe on Twitter or on a Facebook page or something like that. Mm-hmm. And VOA was attacked for putting that out as relaying Chinese propaganda, which, of course, was utterly ridiculous because we repeat something that may be said in Tehran or Moscow or Beijing as part of balanced reporting doesn't mean that we're a propaganda mouthpiece of some foreign government either.
Took heat from who? Did you take heat for who accused you of being Chinese propaganda?
Well, that was the White House. There were a number of instances like that. One day in a speech when this all sort of started to lift off, President Biden was down at the Villages in Florida, and I think probably the topic of the speech was healthcare, Medicare, something like that. In the middle of the speech, he all of a sudden inserts a comment about the Voice of America sounding like the voice of the Soviet Union. And I wasn't on that trip. I was in our White House booth listening to that, and I thought, uh-oh, what brought that on?
Also makes me wonder whether he meant that as a compliment or not, but that's a different issue. It seems like you must be doing something right, Steve Herman, because you seem to get banned by powerful people quite a bit. You were banned by Elon Musk on Twitter for a time for reporting, as I recall, on a Twitter account that used publicly available information to report on the location of Elon Musk's private plane. I think you're back on – well, I know you're back on Twitter now, the site we still call Twitter, because you just tweeted a photo of me. But you write in the book about getting banned from Air Force Two. That's the vice president's plane after you tweeted out a simple photo of Mike Pence on the way to the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota during the pandemic. I think you were the pooler at the time on
yes,
that trip.
Yes.
What happened there?
Yeah, that actually was a couple days after the trip when Mrs. Pence made a remark that the reason, I believe she talked to Fox News about this, that the reason her husband had not worn a mask at the Mayo Clinic was because he didn't know that was the protocol.
Uh-huh.
And I revealed, I thought very innocuously, that we had been given instruction before we went to the Mayo Clinic that masks were mandatory. The vice president's office got very upset that I contradicted Mrs. Pence and then said I had violated a confidentiality agreement because that mask mandate had been contained in a planning document that was not public. My point was the trip was all over, so the logistics about the trip were no longer secret or sensitive.
Right.
But I was told by Katie Miller, Steve Miller's wife in the White House, who was running the press shop for the vice president at the time, that because of this serious infraction, I would be banned forever from, well, at least during that administration, from Air Force Two.
And that, but then I think that ban did not last very long.
No, because I think someone higher up realized this. It was the Barbara Streisand effect, right?
Okay, right.
This, you know, was not that big of a deal until they, you know, banned me from Air Force One and it became a story.
In the opening of your book, Steve Herman, entitled Behind the White House Curtain, you write, quote, whether covering America's nuclear testing program as a rookie reporter in Nevada or numerous disasters and coups overseas as a more experienced foreign correspondent, all these experienced solidified skepticism, especially of what government officials uttered. Talk to me about skepticism as a White House correspondent. How does that come into play as you see it in that particular role?
Well, I think that's the most important role of any White House correspondent. We have these daily press briefings. There are press releases that come out from the White House where they are usually stating something as a certainty. And our job is not, you know, it's important to relay what they're saying, but also as quickly as possible to fact check the White House and to get dissenting opinion from an opposition political party, other politicians, interest groups to take that press release and turn it into a well-rounded and balanced story.
I ask because this comes up a lot, the idea, the job of a reporter in the White House. Some will argue that, oh, it's specifically to simply report what it is that the White House and the administration officials say. Whether it's right or wrong doesn't matter. We need to know what it was they said. Many news outlets make that claim. Or is it the job of those folks in the White House correspondent corps to take what the officials said, match it up against facts, and offer that context? I know you do that, but to offer that context to the audience so that we also can be skeptical because we have that additional information. You're not just telling us what it is the White House said today.
Yeah, the first step is if I'm a poll reporter in the Oval Office, the president is saying something, I want to get out those exact words as accurately and as quickly as possible.
Okay.
Now, it may not, and back then I was tweeting it out, I was sending it out to all the radio poll reports, and then the president is saying something else. You know, sometimes we could be in there for nearly an hour. So there were other people who could instantly start doing the fact checking and put it into context and get reaction to it. So sometimes we are criticized that, you're just a bunch of stenographers.
Yeah.
Well, the first thing is to get that information out mm-hmm. accurately and quickly. Then we have time to flush it out into a fuller story. And sometimes people don't understand that. But what we're doing when we're listening to the president speak, we are trying, when he finishes his remarks, to ask him questions, whether it's in the Oval Office, mm-hmm. the cabinet room, on the tarmac, as the president gets on or comes off of Air Force One, at press conferences, obviously, to not just take what the president is saying verbatim. Now, this sounds fundamentally basic, but there are a lot of people who criticize the White House press, and the mm-hmm. White House press is not monolithic
right,
either.
Right.
It's quite diverse. But there's a lot of criticism that, depending on where you are on the political spectrum and who is the president, that either we're being too deferential mm-hmm. to the president or we're being too mean to the president. So, you know, and I've heard this for years, and that's one reason I wrote Behind the White House Curtain, was to give you an insight mm-hmm. into what it's really like to do this job. What are the obstacles we face? What is the role that we're doing on a day-to-day basis? Because people, you know, have these preconceived notions of what reporters are, and there's such high levels of distrust in the media overall. And I also recount some really bizarre incidents in the book, like when the president was talking outside with a, you know, and that his body seemed to move through the microphone that I was holding. Mm. So therefore, you know, Biden actually had a body double, and, you know, the president wasn't really there. And, you know, it's sort of like the thing that Alex Jones just got yes. into, you know, claiming that basically we were all actors
crisis
in
actors.
A charade.
Right.
Yeah. And you know, I felt compelled to fight back on that one, because it's like, how dare you say that, you know, this is all a fantasy. And it's just gotten, you know, inconceivable to think that people would believe that.
Well, as long as you imagine it, why have the levels of trust for the media as you see it? And this is all the way up, you know, at the White House down to the local level, everywhere else. Why has that eroded over recent years as you see it? What's the reason for that?
I think there are a number of people and entities, some of them outside the United States, who are engaged in what we might call asymmetrical warfare to sow mistrust, doubt, through misinformation, through disinformation, to cause confusion in American society. And it's been effective to some degree. Also, a lot of people now are really into what's called confirmation bias. They're just looking for news sources that reinforce their view mm-hmm. and aren't looking for you know, competing narratives or sources of mm-hmm. information. So that makes it very challenging for reporters. Like I said, I'm dealing with this broadcasting into countries where they don't have a free press, where there's not developed media. But obviously, we have a problem here in the United States as well with the media.
Yes, we do. And by the way, I don't necessarily have a question surrounding this, but I do want to note, based on the photos in your book, it was something that I didn't really realize. You're sort of a one-man wrecking crew. You were in there with the boom mic, and I don't know, is this only when you're doing the pool, when you're covering for the pool, where you got the boom mic, you talk about while you're recording, you're somehow explaining what it is that is being said, and you're somehow tweeting it out.
And taking photos.
And taking photos?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a real, literally, it's a balancing act. I have to find a way to balance the boom pole on yeah. something without hitting the president or the first lady or somebody else on the head.
Hitting them in the head yeah. and staying out of the shots right. for the TV pool, who does not want to see your boom mic hanging above the president's head.
Correct. Yes. It's you know, I guess I'm similar to those people who juggle the plates.
Yes.
Although I wouldn't be able to even juggle one plate, I think.
Very impressive. I hadn't realized. I was thinking, oh, it's Voice of America. They must have a, you know, a two- or three-man crew to
We're
do
We're only allowed
that.
One radio pool reporter. The TV crew is a videographer and a sound person and a producer or a correspondent. So TV has the luxury, the TV pool has the luxury of three people in that little group.
But radio, always the...
Our job is to get the sound.
I see.
So it's a one-person job.
How hard could that be? You discussed the differences in the commercial pressures faced by various outlets who are covering the White House. Talk to me about the difference as discussed in your book, between the way a non-commercial enterprise like Voice of America covers the same news as commercial outlets, whether it's, you know, the network outlets, network news, Bloomberg and so forth, what practical differences do the commercial competitive aspects have on their coverage versus what you can do at the nonprofit Voice of America?
Right. Well, you said the key word there, Brad, which is commercial, right? Competitive.
Yeah.
We're not in competition with any other, well, I would say domestic news organization. We're in competition for the truth, maybe with what's coming out of China, Russia, Iran, et cetera. So we don't have the pressure of ratings, having to worry about advertisers. It's a much, much different here at, you know, KPFK and Pacifica. Yeah. You rely on donations from from the listeners to keep you going. I know you were talking about a pledge drive earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's much, much different. And I've been very, very fortunate. I worked for the Associated Press, which is technically nonprofit as well. So most of my career has been in non-commercial or nonprofit.
Does it allow you more time? Or do you feel the same pressures, speed pressures?
Well,
does it allow you more time to get the story right rather than get the story
well,
fast?
Well, at the Voice of America especially, accuracy is more important than speed. And nobody is ever going to complain that, you know, well, it's okay, just speed it up a little bit. If something's wrong, no worries about it. And that's the way it should be, ideally, in all news organizations. It should be accuracy first and then speed. But there are tremendous speed pressures. You were talking about Bloomberg competing against Reuters. Maybe a fraction of a second makes a difference for, you know, someone who's trading pork bellies on something the president's going to say about agriculture in China. So a completely different environment.
Last question for you, because I got to get out, so I've only got about 30 seconds or so. The book is called Behind the White House Curtain, a senior journalist's story of covering the president and why it matters. So, since I have 30 seconds, why does it ultimately matter? Who did you write this book for, and who are you hoping to reach with this sort of half-memoir, half-history book?
Yeah, I really wanted to go across the political spectrum, not just write an anti-Trump book. Journalism students and people around the world who rely on our information, and to give them a little bit of insight about what happens behind the scenes.
You are a national treasure, Steve Herman. The book is Behind the White House Curtain, a senior journalist's story of covering the president and why it matters. You can find his work, of course, at voanews.com. You can find him on the Twitters and the Mastodons under the name W7VOA. Steve Herman is the chief national correspondent for Voice of America, formerly their White House bureau chief. Thank you, sir. Great to see you as always.
Most welcome.
All right, we got to get out. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to our board operator, Wendell Handy, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, or you just want to share it with someone you know, love, or hate, you can do so by downloading at any time at bradblog.com. Drop me email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter, you will find me at The Brad Blog. We will see you there until we see you here next time, hopefully tomorrow. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.